Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
A few people have had more and varied experience in the politics and government of our country than Ron Klain. He's been involved in two administrations. He served in the, as a staffer in the Senate. He's run campaigns. He's been the debate coach for Democratic presidential candidates going back for decades. He also was the chief counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I sat down with Ron the other day to talk about his life, his career, and this looming battle for the vacancy created by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Ron Klain, you're a sort of an icon of the kind of Washington political government scene, but I went back and read up a little bit about your life. You weren't like raised in a political family, or how'd you get interested in all of this?
Well, you know, it's a great story. I was not raised in a political family at all. My father owned our family's plumbing supply business in Indianapolis, Indiana, and it was an inner city business. Very modest business. But one day in April of 1968. An advanced person decided they needed a place to do a real people event. And so Senator Kennedy's campaign came to my father's plumbing supply business and did the kind of events we've done in politics a million times. And a little thing where he came in and shook hands and, you know, talked about what it was like to do business in the inner city in Indianapolis. And I met Senator Kennedy that day. I was 7 years old. And it absolutely fired.
Was it in Indianapolis where he did his speech?
It was
when Martin Luther King was.
It was the morning after Dr. King was assassinated.
Oh my God!
They had set up this event. They went through and he arrived that night, gave that very famous speech in Indianapolis.
Yeah, maybe the greatest speech of his life.
An amazing, amazing set of remarks. The next morning, got up and went back to the, you know, business of running for president. Did this kind of schmaltzy event.
Were you aware of the speech the night before?
I was not aware of the speech the night before. I was 7 years old, but met him the next day and really. That was it for me. I knew this is what I wanted to be involved in.
So funny, because you and I have this in common. You know, it was Jack Kennedy who got me going. I went and I saw him speak in my little housing development, and that's what got me interested in this.
Yeah.
So did you, from that moment on, you followed it?
We knew this is kind of what I wanted to work in. Came to Washington for college, came to Georgetown University, worked on Capitol Hill while I was in college. And
weren't you an intern in high school as well?
I had come to Washington in high school. Also worked interning for Birch Bayh then, who was my senator.
What kind of guy was he? He seemed like a great guy.
He is an amazing, amazing person. You know, just really incredibly principled, incredibly devoted to the causes he believed in. I worked on his last campaign, his 1980 campaign.
I covered it.
And I my favorite memory of that campaign was I was, you know, obviously still in college and did field work, but sometimes drove him around when the person who usually drove him around wasn't available. And one day we were in Newcastle, Indiana, at the Chrysler factory. And Senator Bayh had voted for the Chrysler bailout. He was running against Dan Quayle, who had voted against the Chrysler bailout. And we're going through this factory, this Chrysler factory, and these two guys came up to him and started needling him, like, you voted to sell out Taiwan. You voted to sell out Taiwan. You voted to give away our canal in Panama. And this is going on, you know? And it was finally, like, when no one else was around, Bayh turned to them and said, I voted to save your jobs. And you're yelling at me about some island that's 7,000 miles away? But that was 1980. That was kind of like the tenor in the field.
That was
of the
a
times.
Harbinger of. I covered that race for the Chicago Tribune, and I rode around with Birch Bayh for 2 days, and then I went and saw Quayle, and Bayh was so personable. He was, you know, if he saw people playing horseshoes, he would stop. He had a horseshoe in his. In his trunk, and he would stop, and he would play horseshoes. He had a shotgun for turkey shoots in the back, and he'd go and he'd give these incredible sort of homespun populist speeches. And I thought, and Quayle was very stiff.
Yeah,
I thought, God, how could Bayh lose this? And now, I mean, I did some reporting, and I figured out how he could lose it. But what a interesting guy he
fantastic
was.
Fantastic guy.
So you came in to Washington to go to college.
Yeah, Georgetown University, and then while I was there, I also
you were the first one in your family to go to college.
First
right?
one to finish. My mom and dad both went, but never finished. While I was there, I started also interning ultimately for then Congressman Markey.
Ed Markey
from Massachusetts. And took a job on his staff after I finished college. And a few months later, Senator Tsongas retired. Ed got in the race and wound up working on and ultimately running his campaign. As long as he was in it, he finally withdrew to won for re-election. But that was
how old were you then?
23 years old. So it was a wild campaign. Ultimately, John Kerry won, but Ed probably made the right decision by getting out of that race, and then 30 years later, finally became a senator.
Yeah. Chose what patience is.
Patience
what a
pays
virtue
off.
Patience is.
Patience pays off.
So then you went to law school.
I did. Went to law school at Harvard, and met up there John Martilla.
One of the great old political consultants.
And John introduced, I knew John a little bit through the Massachusetts politics, my work on the Markey campaign. Dan Payne, who at that time was partners with John, had been our media consultant on the Markey campaign. Anyway, through John, I met Joe Biden and took some time, one of my summers during law school, to work on the Judiciary Committee staff. That's how I got to know Senator Biden.
He was the chairman of the committee.
He was the ranking Democrat on the committee. Mm-hmm. We ultimately took the Senate back, and he became the chairman. I took my third year of law school. I left Harvard, came down to Georgetown to do my third year to work on his staff in preparation for him running for president in 1988. So that's how I got to know him way back in the day.
And then you were counsel to the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, so I actually didn't join the Biden campaign itself. I had committed to go be a law clerk, so I went and clerked for 2 years. When I finished my clerkship, I then joined the Judiciary Committee.
For Justice White.
For Justice White.
Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I had a cousin who was the co-chair of the Colorado for Kennedy campaign with Byron White in 1960. And when I was a kid, I came down to Washington, and she took me over to the Supreme Court to meet him. And like any self-respecting 9-year-old boy, I was transfixed by his football.
Yeah, of course.
Memorabilia more than I was the fact that I was sitting there with a Supreme Court justice. But anyway, that's an aside.
Yeah. Well, he's an amazing figure in American history. He was and probably now always will be the only person in the history of our country who at the same time led the NFL in rushing and was first in his class at Yale Law School at the same time. He went to law school during the week, played in the NFL on the weekends.
Yeah,
and
I feel like if there had been Title IX years ago, Ruth Bader Ginsburg may have been
maybe
the second.
Perhaps.
But anyway, so back to the Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
You were there at a very active time.
Yes, I was there. I was chief counsel of the committee when the committee considered the Souter nomination and then Clarence Thomas's nomination in 1991.
And what did you take away from that experience?
Well, it was... I've been involved in a lot of wild things in my career, but nothing compares to the Thomas hearings. I think it's hard for people today to appreciate how extraordinary it was. In an era before social media, before the internet, we had never really seen anything where politics crossed the line into culture and into cultural life the way that controversy between ultimately between Justice Thomas and Anita Hill really did. It was just wild. And primetime television at a time when that really meant something, and really just a unbelievably dramatic series of events.
The Bork hearings preceded that
yes.
by a few years, and
yeah.
that was the first really contentious. I mean, there was Abe Fortas back in the 60s
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and so on, but that was really when these hearings became, took a sort of sharper edge.
Well, a year before Bork...
You had some of the Nixon appointees.
Well, but just a year before Bork, President Reagan had nominated then-Justice Rehnquist to become Chief Justice. And there was a bit of a fight about that. People may remember a lawyer from San Francisco named Brosnan who stepped forward and said that he had seen Thomas as a young... Rehnquist as a young lawyer harassing voters in a polling place, something that Rehnquist denied under oath. So there were 34, 35 senators who voted against confirming Rehnquist to be Chief Justice. And that kind of was the first blood in the water, if you will. And so a year later, when the Bork nomination came, it kind of came against a backdrop of that. In 86, the Democrats had been in the minority. They had put up 35 no votes. In 87, they were in the majority. And so the kindling was dry and ready for a pretty dramatic fight around the Bork nomination.
Have these Supreme you led to when you were working for Vice President Biden, you led to Supreme Court nomination fights for Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan. Has politics bled too much into these judicial nominating processes?
Well, it has. I mean, and I also worked for President Clinton on Justice Ginsburg's nomination and Justice Breyer's nomination. So I did this twice on the Judiciary Committee, four times in the executive branch. And it has.
But she got confirmed unanimously, didn't she? Or she got 93 votes or
she
something?
She was 96-3.
Yeah.
Breyer was.
That would be inconceivable today.
Inconceivable today. Yeah, and that's a shame, right? I mean, I think that. On the one hand, I think it's completely legitimate for senators to say, you know, I was elected too, and my philosophy is something I can bring to bear on this decision. And I think that to expect that a president will accommodate that complex set of views that a Senate reflects is a reasonable thing. But I think President Obama and President Clinton before him both were very respectful of that in picking justices from the mainstream, justices that certainly reflected, you know, a Democratic point of view in some general way, but were not at the far left extreme of our jurisprudence. And I think justices should be evaluated on that basis. And I think it's just become this you know, like a lot of other things in our public life, very highly politicized, very highly partisanized and very polarized. I mean, the idea that they wouldn't even get a hearing, that they wouldn't even have a chance to present themselves to the American people, that's obviously unprecedented and unfortunate.
Now, you were probably working for Senator Biden back in 92 when he made this speech that has become so much part of the news lately. The Republicans were pretty gleeful about recounting that speech in which he said presidents shouldn't replace justices in the final year. What was you may have been involved in that speech.
Yep.
What was the thinking behind that?
Well, I think you have to be very precise about what Senator Biden said back then. So let's set the stage. That speech was given in June of 1992. It was just 8 months after the Thomas nomination, a nomination that President Bush had made 3 days after the vacancy occurred, without consulting members of the Senate, without considering the issues about the balance between the Senate and the White House, and had resulted in a conflagration that I think was unhealthy for the court, unhealthy for our country. And what Senator Biden said in that speech was basically, if President Bush tries to do this the same way in an election year, then I'm going to block that nomination. But he also said in that speech that if, on the other hand, President Bush consulted widely with the Senate, p- pick someone who was a consensus candidate, then he would go ahead and proceed to confirm that person. So people are quoting half the speech, mm-hmm. but not the whole speech.
Not unprecedented.
Not unprecedented. And out of context, out of the context of the backdrop of that Thomas nomination. And in the end, Axe, you know, there's one bottom line here, which is that Joe Biden was the ranking Democrat or chairman of the Judiciary Committee for over a decade. Every Supreme Court nomination while he was in that role, every time, got a hearing. The person got out of committee and got a floor vote, even if Biden was against them. And both Bork and Thomas, Biden voted no, but still they got their votes on the floor and on a 51-vote up or down vote, either got confirmed or not confirmed. That's the actual record here, and that should be applied here as well.
Let's start with Merrick Garland.
Yeah, I mean, I've known Judge Garland for a very long time. I was a summer associate at Arlen Porter when he was a partner, and he's been a friend ever since then. We worked together in the Clinton administration Justice Department. He is an outstanding legal mind. He is an incredibly objective and fair-minded person. And I think in any kind of normal political universe, he's the kind of person that would be confirmed to the Supreme Court unanimously. And
he was a prosecutor, prosecuted the Oklahoma City bombers.
Exactly. He oversaw the prosecution of the Oklahoma City bombing case in the Clinton years. He was a prosecutor here in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. Attorney's Office, a law partner here, very involved in civic affairs, and has now been on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals since 1997 or 98. And you know, by all accounts, is a very highly acclaimed, highly accomplished jurist.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the odds of getting this nomination confirm? I mean, I guess there's the question: will it be heard?
Yeah.
Can the Republicans resist having a hearing? They seem to fear that if they have a hearing, that they'll then become under pressure to confirm the nominee.
Yeah. This is a little bit like, you know, Odessa's being bound to the mast. They're, I guess, afraid of being so persuaded by a great nominee. They don't even want to listen. You know, they're trying to plug their ears. I think it's going to be very hard for them to sustain their position. This is a fair country, and I think that the idea that someone doesn't even get a hearing, doesn't even get a chance to present their case, doesn't even get a chance to be heard, I think is very going to rub a lot of people the wrong way.
But moving forward, we'll rub the Republican base the wrong way. We had Eric Erickson, who you probably know, on this podcast a few weeks ago, and he said this is a unpardonable offense. Anyone who allows this nomination to go forward is going to be excommunicated from the Republican Party.
Well, I think that you know, Eric is a very loud and effective voice, but I don't think he's the Pope of the Republican Party, and I'm not sure excommunication is within his power. And in fact, Chuck Grassley is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He's in a interesting competitive race now with Patty Judge running.
I love that his opponent's name is Judge. Just got rub it in.
Yeah, you know? How can you beat that, right?
Yes.
And I think he's also, you know, I worked with him when I was on the Judiciary Committee staff. He is a reasonable person, and I think that his basic sense of fairness will be appealed to here. I think it will be, you know, look, they can pull up speeches and comments on both sides, but the fact is, 125 years, every nominee's gotten a hearing. I don't understand how you explain why this person doesn't even get a hearing. I
mean, or meetings.
Or meetings, courtesy calls, all these things. It just seems like they're on a path of really being out of step with where the American people are. I suppose they can stay on that path, but I don't think they will.
You said you've been involved in some wild things in your career. You became something of a cultural figure back in the early 2000s because you were a key player in the recount in 2000 in Florida. In the pantheon of wild things you've been involved in, how wild was that one?
Well, very wild. I mean, you know, on the high end of wild also.
Anyway, by the way, we should point out, anybody who wants to know more about this can watch the movie Recount, in which Kevin Spacey plays you.
Yes, he does. Yes.
Was that, how weird was that?
That was pretty weird. Very weird, I guess. Weird to go see you were self-portrayed by a famous actor.
Who got your idiosyncrasies. Now, I don't know if you know that, but you know, when you, we've been in many meetings together, and when you're intensely considering what's being said, you tend to look, stare down at the table.
Yeah.
And he got all of that. Did he spend time with you?
We spent a little bit of time together. So he, you know, I don't know. It's a strange thing. I've seen that movie a bunch of times. Every time it has the same ending, and that's all I really care about. It's a very sad ending every time.
Yeah.
I wish I could watch it once and we would win. But it was, you know, an unbelievable 36 days, something we've never really seen before in our history. A horrible injustice was done. The candidate who got the most votes was not inaugurated as president. The candidate who had the most votes in Florida was not inaugurated as president.
Well, that's the matter. That's the disputed matter, right? Because according to the record, George W. Bush won Florida by 527 votes.
Yeah. No, I understand. That's what his campaign chairman, who was the Secretary of State of the state of Florida, certified as the vote in Florida, and what his brother, who was the governor of Florida, ensured that stuck. But if we had seen this happen in another country, we definitely would have called in election observers, if not the 101st Airborne. And, you know, it's just an unacceptable outcome in a democracy that something like that is allowed to happen at the hands of partisan operatives for
your
opponent's
campaign.
Although
not just partisan operatives, because the United States Supreme Court essentially put its imprimatur on that. I thought about you the other day a few weeks ago when Justice Scalia passed away, because he wrote that opinion, Bush v. Gore. You're a constitutional expert. What was your feeling about that ruling, and what did it do? What did it do in terms of public confidence in the court?
Well, first of all, you know, I got to know Justice Scalia a little bit when I clerked at the court, and he was a funny, kind person. And in the years subsequent, he gave an interview to 60 Minutes 6 or 7 years ago where he kind of famously said, a lot of people are still upset about this Bush v. Gore thing. I say, get over it. You should just get over it. And so in the subsequent years after that, we would see each other at public events, and I would frequently say in public, you know, like, I'm not over it. I'll never be over it. We shouldn't be over it as a country. And he was always good-natured about that.
You know, I think often about how different history would be if that result had gone the other way, because some very consequential decisions were made. The decision to go into Iraq, the decision to spend down the surplus, the decision to, you know, I assume Al Gore would have pursued climate change as a serious and energy transformation of our energy as a major goal. It was really a consequential
event. And you obviously can't unwind and peel back history. And whenever I have this conversation with people, people point out to me, conversely, maybe Barack Obama would not have become president had Al Gore become president in 2000. So you can't like pick and choose your hypothetical undoing of history. But there's no question we had huge consequences for it, specifically the war in Iraq and the tax cuts. I also think it was a horrible thing for the Supreme Court as an institution to allow that decision to happen on a 5-4 basis, a partisan basis, the 5 justices appointed by Republicans voting for Bush, the 4 justices appointed by Democrats voting for Gore. I think that added to the sense that the Supreme Court's a political institution. It kind of ripped away a bit of a veneer around the court. And if you look at polls, public confidence in the court never really has recovered from that. Court used to be held up as a different kind of institution in our life. And now, ever since Bush v. Gore, it's seen as a much less respected, much more partisan institution.
Yeah. The we served together in the White House when you were Vice President Biden's chief of staff. One of your assignments early on was to oversee the Recovery Act, the big stimulus bill. Talk a little bit about that, because that was almost $1 trillion out the door within a short period of time. How challenging was that?
Well, it was challenging, and I think it reflected everything that is incredibly admirable about President Obama and that has been at times frustrating about his presidency, which is, I think, as you certainly know better than I do, you know, President Obama was a person who believed that if we do the right things, the politics will take care of themselves. And the Recovery Act was the right thing. It was not perfect, had its own flaws, but was a very impactful, very wonk-driven piece of legislation that really saved this country, along with the other things the president did, from going off the cliff in the Great Depression, Great Recession. And the president was very clear. He wanted to implement it in a very apolitical, very effective, very efficient way. I thought we had great success in that. We beat all the targets for getting the money out the door. We set records for how little fraud and waste and abuse there was in the distribution of $800 billion in 20 months.
Even the one that the opponents point to, Solyndra, right, is now, I think Solar City has taken over that plant.
Yeah.
And it's like churning out solar panels.
Yes, and I mean, on that side, we had a $30 billion portfolio of clean energy investments. Some of them failed, but the success rate of the projects under that part of the Recovery Act was higher than all the best venture capital firms have when they do this. And Solyndra itself was a bit of a hedging play, which is we invested in two kinds of solar technology, knowing that if one succeeded, the other would probably fail. That was the best thing for the country. And one of them succeeded wildly. We have an explosion of solar use under President Obama, an explosion of wind power due to some of the investments in the Recovery Act. Electric batteries in cars is something else the Recovery Act invested in. But, you know, we didn't successfully persuade the American people that this was working. We didn't successfully persuade the American people that this was an effective program. And so we, you know, paid a political price for that.
Now, you're in an interesting position because you're helping Hillary Clinton now. I want to talk a little bit about you as debate maestro. We brought you in 2008, the Obama campaign, to help prepare the president for the presidential debates again in 2012. But you've played that role for decades with different Democratic candidates. But you're also very close to Joe Biden. Were you disappointed when this opportunity to run for president didn't open up for him?
You know, I know how difficult the loss of his son was to the vice president and his family, to all of us who care about him, and, you know, to everything there is a time and a season, and it just was clear to me that he wasn't personally in a place where running for president really was an option. And, you know, and actually, you know, you hear that from political figures all the time, my family. But you know, Vice President Biden, you know that in this case, that really is the first thing.
No, I'll tell you, when I first really met him was when David Plouffe and I went to interview him to become, for vice president. There were three finalists. He was one of them. I went to see him, and Beau Biden and Jill Biden picked us up at the airport. It was all clandestine. We were meeting at a secret, undisclosed location. And it's the thing that struck me immediately was the love between all of them. And when we got there, and Senator Biden arrived, he kissed Bo and said, "I love you. I may come by later to see the kids." And I went back to see the Senator Obama, and I said, "There's something special about this family." Mm-hmm. And the love between them was so palpable.
Yeah. So I will say this: I worked for Joe Biden off and on for 30 years, and I learned a lot about politics from him, but. The biggest lesson I learned from him is how to be a father. And a lot of what I've tried to do as a father in my own personal life has been modeled from the way the vice president is devoted to and supportive of his children. So I think Beau's illness and Beau's ultimate passing just really made any effort by him to run for president's time just impossible.
I mentioned earlier that you're sort of the go-to guy on debates. Everybody always asks me about the period running up to that first debate, in Denver for President Obama, and which, you know, my great recollection of it was you in the first 10 minutes of the debate pacing vigorously in the room in which we were all watching, saying, "This is a disaster." And it was a disaster. Yeah. Why was it a disaster? What happened?
Well, you know, I think kind of everything that could go wrong did go wrong that night. I think that, first of all, we had just, as you will certainly recall, had just widened our lead over Mitt Romney in the races right after the 47% thing. And I think we got a little bit cautious. We got a little bit of, went into the four corners offense here with 2 months left to go in the campaign, and sent him in with a very cautious game plan that turned out to be a mistake. I think that was one thing. I think that Mitt Romney somewhat surprised us after having stayed so far to the right the whole race, that night, all of a sudden, boom, moved to the center. And I don't think we had prepared him well for that. I think three, you know, President Obama always kind of eschewed a lot of the political theatrics that are part of politics today. And again, I love him for this. I think is what has made him a great president. But that night, not being into political theatrics, made him a less than great candidate. I think that was part of it. And then finally, it really was the impact of social media. You know, this was the first debate ever that was where the perception of the debate was shaped in real time by people reacting to it on Twitter. And the reaction by some liberals on Twitter, that, you know, "Oh my God, Obama's doing so terrible. Oh my God, it's awful. Oh my God, it's horrible." That was something we had never really seen before. We hadn't really prepared for that. We didn't really have our own voices on Twitter competing that. And so, you know, I've watched that tape now several times. I think in fairness...
You're a brave man.
I think President Obama loses that debate 60-40, but I think the Twitter reaction made it a 90-10 kind of event.
Yeah. I think there's one other factor, and you and I talked about it a lot leading up to that debate. The history of presidents going into the first debate is not very good. Presidents aren't used to having someone 4 feet away from them on an equal plane calling them out, and they don't like it.
Yeah.
And we could see that in the prep.
Well, that is true. I mean, six incumbent presidents now have debated since we started debates in 1976, the modern series, and of the six who've debated, five of them have lost the first debate.
Bill Clinton was
96, the only exception against Bob Dole. And I think it's part of that. It's part that they're rusty. You know, Mitt Romney had debated 23 times that spring in the primaries. Barack Obama had not. It is the fact that they're confronted. And then it's also the fact that, you know, Mitt Romney had only one job, which was to get ready for that debate. Barack Obama was running the country. And so, as you know, a lot of times our practice sessions with him were curtailed. A lot of his time to prepare was really curtailed. The guy was president of the United States and leader of the free world. Mitt Romney was a candidate for president. Obviously, one is more conducive to getting ready for the debate than the other.
Yeah. Tell me about Hillary Clinton as a debater. What's it like working with her?
Well, you know, she's a very, very good debater. She's very fast on her feet understands this. She's now debated President Obama 28 times in 2008. Right. That's certainly a very, you know, excellent preparatory experience.
For him, too, I actually thought the reason he did as well as he did against McCain was he had a great sparring partner for the previous.
You know, she comes into this with a lot of experience and clearly, I think, has been very effective in the debates and making her points. And I think certainly, has done well in the debates.
What about Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think
as a debater.
Yeah, I think Senator Sanders, was newer to this, but is also, you know, skilled in making his points. He's got a very clear and focused message and uses the debates to get that across. I think both of them have said, and I certainly agree with this, that as Democrats, you have to be proud to watch our debates and see the two of them have substantive exchanges, obviously differences of opinion, sometimes sharp differences of opinion, but differences of opinion on issues about the future of our country, not their respective hand size or spray tans or some of the stuff you're seeing in the Republican debate. So I think I think there are a lot to be proud of. I think it's also fascinating that these debates are drawing massive audiences. I mean, the most viewed, you had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, two amazing transformative figures, debate in 2008.
I think 8 million was the most.
8 million was the peak. And and basically every one of these debates has drawn that audience sometimes twice as much.
Right.
At a time when people have a lot more things they could be doing with their time. You know, they don't have to be watching television. So
hasn't that played to Sanders' advantage, though, because he was so less known than Hillary?
Well, I think it's worked to both of their advantage. I certainly think it's getting Sanders' message out. That certainly helps him. But I think you look at particularly the first debate in October at a time when people had questions about her candidacy, at a time when her polling numbers were down a little bit, and she gave a very, very strong performance there in Las Vegas, that first debate. And it really, I think, transformed perceptions of her candidacy.
Right.
15 million people watching, I think it was a big boost for her.
Sometimes it seems as if she has a hard time being revealing of herself. Why is that? What is it that makes her so reserved about sort of sharing personal feelings and...
Well, you know, I think she believes that there are very few people in our public life who have been as scrutinized and speculated about and as analyzed as Hillary Clinton. And I think sometimes she just believes that basically it's kind of all out there and people form their own judgments. You know, she is, by her own acknowledgement, not a natural politician and very focused on policy. And I think, you know, she wants to be president to make the country a better place. And that's what she likes to talk about. She likes to talk about her ideas to improve the economy, improve health care. You know, that's kind of her focus. That's what drives her. And I think that's what she more naturally talks about.
She also, she says, and I think it's been affecting when she says she's not a natural politician. It's obviously true, but she is a veteran of government.
Yeah.
And she seems, you know, she's in the position of being the voice of what is possible, the voice of pragmatism, versus this more kind of idealistic, you know, sweeping rhetoric of Bernie Sanders. Isn't it hard to, I mean, it's like you're telling everybody what is possible, what we can't do and what we can do. Doesn't that put her in an awkward position? I mean, I'm not criticizing because I think she's right about, I mean, you know, we couldn't get a public option in the healthcare plan. I asked Bernie Sanders about this on the podcast. So how are we going to get single payer? I mean, these are legitimate questions, but there are a lot of folks who just don't, who are tired of being told what the limitations are, particularly on the left of the Democratic Party.
Well, I mean, I obviously see it differently. I mean, I think she is proposing a bold, transformative agenda to go and finish the job on universal health care, to make preschool universal, to have debt-free college. I think these are all really big ideas that she's saying, and she's saying how we'll pay for them in a way that's also exciting and bold in terms of raising taxes on the rich and closing a lot of these loopholes. I think Senator Sanders, you know, I mean, he has an agenda that is interesting, but he hasn't really explained how he will pay for it, how the promises all add up. And I think, unfortunately, you know, I think on the long run, that sort of stuff only adds to some of the cynicism we have in politics. I think one thing that I most admire and respect about President Obama is that he's always been very careful not to overpromise, to tell the American people what he's going to do and then go do that. I think that's really important. If you're a progressive and you want to believe that people can believe in their government again, then having promises that are achievable, having promises that you're going to deliver on, is an important part of restoring faith in the government. I think President Obama's tried to do that, and I think the agenda Secretary Clinton's laid forward in this campaign is consistent with that.
finally, I want to ask you about it. You're sort of the crisis manager, so you got called into the White House during the Ebola crisis,
yeah.
Which was interesting to people because you're not a medical person. You're a lawyer. First of all, were you surprised when you got that call?
I was quite surprised when I got that call. My phone rang one morning, and it was Dennis McDonough, the White House Chief of Staff, and he said, you're going to get this call, and I just want to tell you what this call is going to be so you can think about it before you get this call. And I was shocked a little bit and surprised. But, you know, I think it reflects something I mentioned earlier about the president that I admire and respect, which is he does have a disdain for political theatrics. And the theatrics of the moment were that he should have picked a famous doctor or a general to run the Ebola response. The reality is we had the two very best doctors you could have working on it, Tom Frieden and Tony Fauci.
Right.
And another doctor would have actually just disrupted the flow of medical advice to the president. And we didn't need a general. You needed someone who could come in and tee up policy decisions for the president in an orderly way, get the right decisions in front of the president, to help coordinate a lot of the infighting in the bureaucracy, to do a lot of the stuff we had done on the Recovery Act. I think that's why the president asked me to do it, because I think he saw the task as very similar to the task on the Recovery Act, to coordinate the bureaucracy, to get the policy issues worked out, to try to make things work effectively and efficiently. And even though that really wasn't the right political theater, I think it was the right instinct. And
although there was so much theatrics surrounding that whole piece. I mean, one of the things you're a great manager, so I understood that decision. You're also a good message guy. And what happened around that Ebola thing was sort of a parable of kind of what's wrong with modern media, what's wrong with modern politics, in that we had a few cases here. Those guys who you mentioned, Fauci and Frieden, world-class public health experts, assured the country that we weren't going to have a major outbreak here, that we could handle it. But the news media and particularly politics and the politicians of the opposition went nuts and said, we don't believe you. And so sort of panic ensued,
yeah.
or at least panic as portrayed by the media. So I presume that one of your jobs was to restore sanity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, President Obama made it very clear that he was going to make decisions based on science and facts and not let fear and panics and politics dominate his decision making. And so at every juncture along the way, he chose the medically right, the scientifically right course. And didn't do the politically expedient thing, which was to try to really capture and manage these fears. And it worked. Yeah. It was the right strategy.
Well, literally weeks after sort of the peak of the panic, the thing sort of passed from public view, and there was a sense that, I guess this wasn't the crisis that we anticipated or feared.
I think a critical event in that was, we had Dr. Craig Spencer come back from fighting Ebola in West Africa, came to New York, turned out to have Ebola. Before he was diagnosed, he had ridden the subway. He had gone bowling in Brooklyn. He had been in an Uber. He'd eaten a meatball sandwich. And there was this moment of panic in New York that this guy had been all over town with Ebola. And I think when the president's view on this, that we needed travelers back and forth to West Africa to fight the disease. If we didn't go fight the disease in West Africa, we would see more of it here on our shores. To send people to fight, that means you had to let them come home after they had been over there. That we didn't need quarantines because it would discourage that. That we could manage this by tracking people after they got back in the country, taking their temperature, getting them to care if they ever turned positive. And that we could do all that without having large outbreaks here in the United States. You know, that was proven right. And the Craig Spencer thing was proven right in the largest city in our country. I think that did a lot to tamp down the fears and assuage the fears. I also think, again, to the president's great credit, every time he spoke about the issue, he, and a little different maybe than others, he said time and again, you know, we will have cases from time to time in the United States. And even though a lot of his advisors inside the White House, as you can imagine,
yes,
really freaked out at that, tried to keep crossing that sentence out of speeches, saying, why are you telling the people this?
Yeah.
He was quite insistent. Look, we got to tell them. This is going to happen from time to time. We will manage it. We will not have a big outbreak here, but we got to be straight with the American people. That was a big part of his communication around this.
Well, brother, you have been involved in so much history. It's kind of incredible to talk about it all. But I'm so happy that you were able to come by today. Thanks for being here, Ron Klain.
Thanks for having me, David.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.